Welcome back to another edition of Why Football Happens. It's another edition of our reaction podcast as we have a semi-final set in stone for Euro 2020 Spain against Italy after the Spaniards squeeze past the Swiss via a penalty shootout this Friday afternoon before, of course, the grand finale of the evening. Italy against Belgium and arguably the game of the tournament so far. There was plenty to break down from both of these two ties. So myself, Ollie Wilson and Stephen Drennan did exactly that. Remember, you can stay up to date with everything going on at Why Football Happens by following us on Twitter, @podcast_WFH. That's @podcast_WFH. And let's just dive into all the discussion points from today's games. For me, and I say this with no bias at all, I genuinely think that's the game of the tournament that we've seen. Because we watched France-Germany to kick off the group of death, and we said that's two sides playing at arguably their best. And we've just seen two sides who are perhaps the two best sides in European football at this point, playing possibly their best football. I know Belgium, obviously, without Eden Hazard, for instance, would have made a huge impact in going forward and trying to get that equalising goal. But both Italy and Belgium played their socks off tonight and gave us, for the neutral, a wealth of entertainment and quality in that football game.
Yeah, it was a great game to watch. I think it was interesting as well that it was the first half seemed very tactical. Very cagey, and then Italy scored, it sort of opened up a bit more. The second half was sort of very ragged. Belgium sort of were very open. Italy were able to run through them quite a few times. I was surprised, to be honest, that it finished 2-1. It just felt like at any point, Italy could score one and then Belgium would collapse in that second half. Likewise, there was times where it looked like Belgium were just going to get an equaliser. That Lukaku miss, for example, was just insane. I still can't believe it didn't go in. Like, you'd bet your whole house on him scoring that. It was insane. It was just such a great match to watch. There were so many big moments in it.
That Lukaku miss for Belgium is the biggest moment of their tournament so far, and somehow that stays out. There have been times, and this may be being overcritical of Lukaku, because I'm a huge fan of him, and think he's a very much a complete centre forward that had a hard ride when he was an English footballer at Chelsea and Manchester United in particular. But there have been times where he's just lacked maybe that bit of luck in front of goal, and it just doesn't seem to go his way. And it seemed in that moment that was highlighting a night where perhaps it just wasn't going to go in for Belgium. Try as much as they might, and even obviously with the teenager Doku as well on, it just wasn't falling for them.
Yeah, I think a lot of goal scorers, I think whenever they're scoring like most of the chances that come their way, you sort of just forget how many big chances they miss. But if you look at how many big chances top scorers miss, there's basically an exact correlation between players who miss big chances and players who score the most goals, because you need to be getting those chances to score them. And even the top players are probably only converting maybe like 60% of them, 50% of them. So, and that's the thing. It's like that Lukaku chance, it's coming across the pitch quickly. It's coming through a bunch of players, and he's kind of reacting to it last minute with his weak foot. And you just think if it was on his left foot, he probably scores that with absolute ease. And it's on his right foot. And you also have to acknowledge the defender who done well as well. He's like, the defender's put himself in the spot where it's most likely to go. Mm-hmm. If Lukaku just stabs a leg at it, aiming to get it on target, it's probably going to go where the defender positioned himself. So, yeah, you probably have to credit the defender a little bit as well, but I just think if that's on his left foot, he smashes that high into the goal.
It was something that social media was abuzz about, the Spinazzola block on Lukaku's effort and the way that Italy reacted to that, and a couple of other defensive stands that they had of, you know, the cliche tropes were coming out. Italians love defending more than they love scoring. Look how they're celebrating that. But actually, you look at this Italy side, and as you say, in the first half, the tactical setup, and the second half, just the way at times they tore through that Belgian defence, albeit a Belgian defence that isn't perhaps at its strongest necessarily than it has been in previous years with the age of the back three they're playing with. But I think the statement that Italian football is boring and defensive needs to now be thrown out of the window from what we've seen, at least under Mancini, and what we've seen from Italy tonight against one of the best sides in the tournament, because they did go man for man, attacking football at times. And again, it, I don't want to sound biased because I did pick them to do well in this tournament, but it's hard not to coo about them. It was a joy aesthetically to watch them go about their business, and the fluidity as well, the overlaps. I mean, losing Spinazzola for the rest of this tournament potentially is so disheartening for the neutral, because he's probably been the player of the tournament and certainly one of the players that's had the most plaudits from neutral fans that never recognised perhaps how good he was. Di Lorenzo as well supporting. I mean, Barella on the overlap with Chiesa tonight. Insigne, as I say, and Spinazzola. Verratti's a walking yellow card and he gets it quite early, and you're always worried about that. But Jorginho, again, in the heart of the pitch, is phenomenal at controlling the game at times. Chiellini this evening, from the moment that the anthem was being played, just looked like he was enjoying himself. When he gets that block on De Bruyne's effort in the first half, he's kind of pointing to him and laughing and saying, yeah, that was me, I got in the way of that, my bad, no, sorry. I mean, he just was the belle of the ball this evening at 36 years old. He was loving it. There was something really different about the composure of this Italy team and the enjoyment they got from the way they played and the whole moment and atmosphere, whereas at other times you've expected Italy to be nervous in the past in these big occasions. And that was the one thing that they never really came across as, even if Italy fans were nervous in those final few moments. I didn't feel like them on the pitch were actually too worried, and it wasn't too kind of last man standing, get a block in however you can, for the majority of the game, even though, of course, that did happen on occasion.
Yeah, I really enjoyed watching it late tonight. I think a lot of people who watch sports at the very, very top level probably don't appreciate how much everything matters. Like, literally every single thing you do matters. And in the same way as defense, that big moment in defense is just as important as Barella's goal. Without one, the other one doesn't count for as much. And so I see a lot of people who criticize things that sports people get excited about, but it's about you're constantly preparing yourself, like training constantly for those moments. And when you get it right in those moments, it's a relief. It's a release. And so I don't understand the criticism. I think the criticism comes just from a position of ignorance. Basically, it's I remember watching Olympic wrestling with Kurt Angle. And Kurt Angle was getting excited about the fact that his opponent was tired and he wasn't. It's just like, it's because he trained so hard and he thought, yes, I was right, it was worth it. I'm not tired and the other guy is. And so it's just that thing about all the stuff that you do and you prepare yourself for, when it comes together, it all makes it worthwhile. It's like, yeah, all those hours of training, it was all worthwhile. So I never understand that criticism. I love that. Spinazzola's very injuries just really disappointing for me, because he was my player of the tournament so far. I thought he's almost Italy's best attacker, which is insane to say, but for a left back, but he just, in the same sense for me as a Liverpool fan, Trent Alexander-Arnold runs games for us. It's like Spinazzola just ran games for Italy at left back, and that's insane to see at the top level, but phenomenal player. I'm gutted he's injured. From his reaction, I'm guessing he won't play further part of the tournament. I hope it's not more it's not any more serious than that. I hope it's not like a bad knee injury or something. But yeah, I'm just gutted he's not going to be involved in the tournament. And I wonder what that changes for Italy, because I think in the sense that he gives them all the width on their left flank, and that's allows Insigne a lot of freedom just to wander around looking for pockets of space. I don't think Emerson is anywhere near as effective. I don't think he's going to stretch teams in the way Spinazzola does. And that would be my worry going forward for Italy, is that you lose a big dynamic in your team. And yeah, Mancini's going to probably have to do a little change to probably keep the effectiveness of that. And be curious to see what he does.
Yeah, I'd be interested. I mean, I said to everybody in the WhatsApp group when Emerson came on, and already he's a fresh substitute and he's not running half as hard as Spinazzola was to get back when Belgium break down that side of the field. And you're like, well, where, you can't have this being the replacement for somebody who's been so important with his ability and energy to get up and down the field as Spinazzola has done. As you say, it unleashes Insigne. It gives them a lot of still defensive discipline in the way he tracks back. I think for me as well this evening, that was one thing that I absolutely loved. Not just Spinazzola and Di Lorenzo getting back and performing their defensive duties, but how quickly Chiesa and Insigne as well were putting in that same effort level to get back and support the defensive unit. And then 2 seconds later, they're straight up the other end of the field and leading the charge. Maybe because Toloi, who came on as a substitute, has played actually at the right back position for Italy in the past and for Atalanta as well. I wonder if perhaps they put Toloi in at right back as a more solid, stable defender on that side, and then bring across maybe a Di Lorenzo and put him in at left back just to have that same pace that then releases Insigne, whereas Chiesa can kind of run a show on a right-hand flank. We will see what happens with that. But yeah, huge loss for this Italy side, not having Spinazzola. I mean, other than other takeaways from the game, I mean, Ciro Immobile, I thought actually was one of the standouts that let us down from an Italy performance. But his going down inside the 18-yard box may have been pivotal to allowing the opening goal, because he almost, I think it's Thomas Vermaelen who stood over him and reacts to Immobile being down on the deck and feigning injury. And he's too busy dealing with that when I think it was Vertonghen loses it, trying to run it out from the back. And suddenly, Vermaelen's slightly out of position and then coming across at a hurry to close down Barella. And it's all a bit erratic, as opposed to if he hadn't been paying attention to Immobile feigning injury on the deck. And it's just funny how that, when you looked at the close-up of Immobile, actually paid off. And we bemoan strikers for doing exactly what he's done, and he gets up straight away and starts celebrating with the rest of the team. But I do think it just affected the Belgian backline a little bit with him being down there and feigning that injury, and it ends up paying off. But he was a big letdown in not distributing at times and being a touch too selfish. And that may be something that Mancini should look at, because that was something that was hinted at going into this game, that maybe with Belotti's scoring record in Italian football compared to Immobile, it's far better. Maybe that would be the other change that could come in for this evening's game of mixing up at centre forward. Was there anything that you thought the Belgians could have done more this evening?
Well, the one thing I would say is that towards the end of the game, I thought Italy were very compact and very narrow and very deep. You could like throw a net over them, basically. And I was thinking back to that Portugal versus Germany game, where whenever Portugal were in positions like that, Germany were just pinging the ball across the pitch and finding width on the other side. And you're making the opposition shift across the pitch constantly. And that's how gaps appear. And you create 1v1 situations, or you isolate a defender who, if someone hasn't tracked back. And it just felt like Belgium didn't really have anybody who could do that on the pitch other than De Bruyne. But De Bruyne is also needed in as a playmaker. In the sort of number 10 spot, he was sort of staying between the lines, trying to stay close enough to Lukaku to make something happen. So I thought that was the only thing towards the end of the game where it was very noticeable where all the space was on the pitch, and Belgium were just entirely incapable of finding the space. I thought Italy were phenomenal towards the end and just basically just controlling where and how Belgium had the ball, and they weren't going to let Belgium play it forward. They would only let them play it sideways or backwards, and then ultimately Belgium just ended up hoofing it forward, and then it became like a 50-50 header of Chiellini, which is actually like a 80-20 header. Chiellini just won pretty much everything, and then they just couldn't get the ball forward. They couldn't get it down in the Italian half. So it was a bit disappointing from Belgium's point of view. They didn't seem to have any solution to that. I thought De Bruyne would probably drop deep and start making sure the ball was getting into the final third, and then let someone like Doku or Hazard take over and try and create something with it. But the ball just didn't really get into the final third enough. I really like Doku. I thought he was very good with the ball, carrying it at pace, dribbling, opening up spaces. I think I remember I wrote an article on him basically saying it's like Adama Traore. He has no end product, but it isn't a problem because there's two different things. There's end product and penetration. Penetration is basically like interrupting the opponent's shape, pulling people all over the place, committing defenders. If you commit a defender, someone else has to step out to you. And he's very, very good at doing that. And that creates spaces for other people. And you saw it constantly tonight, even though he never had the final pass or scores many goals, but it's very impactful. The other thing I would mention as well was Donnarumma towards the end when he comes out for that cross, and Chiellini looks like elbows Donnarumma in the stomach and Donnarumma goes down and he gets a free kick. And it's just, it's that thing we were saying with the Lloris penalty shout, where goalkeepers seem to have this special rule where if anyone touches them when they come out for a cross, it's a foul. And I don't really like it because I don't understand what Witzel's meant to do either. He has to contest the ball. It's a bit weak.
Yeah, any goalkeeper that comes into a crowded 18-yard box and they commit to it immediately, you know a free kick's being given. And yeah, I think Italy certainly got away with that one. Although the follow-up attempt, there were about five bodies on the line. I think it was initially blocked anyway. But yeah, I mean, absolutely awful decision, I think, that one. The other thing, just talking about Chiellini, you mentioned him a couple of times there, is how he, for large parts of the game, actually locked up Romelu Lukaku, who is such a dangerous centre forward in world football and has often been underrated at times, as I said earlier, when his Premier League days. And to keep him under wraps in the way that Chiellini and to some extent Bonucci, but it was mainly Chiellini in the first half in particular, I thought was very impressive. And it basically meant that they could double team De Bruyne quite a lot, which then made life very difficult for him. And even then they were able to create chance. I mean, Doku nearly scores the goal of the tournament at one point when he weaves inside in the second half onto his right boot and sends it over the top of the crossbar. But the Italians put on a very good performance. It'd be interesting to see how the injuries and niggles affect them going into the semi-final. A semi-final which I think some people may have half predicted in terms of, you could see it happening on kind of calibre and reputation, but Spain have made life difficult to get to the semi-finals, and it wasn't an easy task again when they took on Switzerland earlier today.
Yeah, it was another game that I sort of generally enjoyed watching. Again, had so much happening in it. The difference between this game and the Italy one, I thought, was that in the Italy-Belgium game, a lot of what was happening was in open play, but it felt like in the Spain versus Switzerland game, all the major things that happened in the game revolved around set pieces. I think Switzerland's goal was the only chance they probably had that wasn't from a set piece. But they had so many headers from point blank range that it sort of didn't really manage to connect with and hit the target. There was a moment in the game that I thought was very interesting when, who was it? I think it was Azpilicueta had a free header. And I think it was Akanji that was challenging him for it. And he basically, Akanji felt the contact and went down, but it was very minimal contact. And I wonder whether VAR has maybe changed how some defenders think, where they think if someone scores a goal and they have a hand on them and they go down in the replay, the goal will be disallowed. And that's just taking a massive risk because you're giving someone a free header in the hope that they're going to disallow the goal for minimal contact on you. And I really didn't like that because I used to play centre-back, and so just going down really weak when someone touches you, it's just like, what are you doing? And then at the other end, like literally minutes later, I think it was Elvedi had a header, but as he was about to head it, Pau Torres nudged him and he couldn't get a good contact on it and just headed it off target. And I just thought, that's the difference between those two moments where, like, if you put a guy off, it's much, much better than trying to hope a decision goes your way, going down really weakly in the box. So that was one of the things I noticed in that game that bugged me quite a lot.
I thought as well, you've been waxing lyrical about the chances that Spain create. And I know Alvaro Morata, there was the idea that goal in the round of 16 would silence his critics. And I still think this Spain side, I know Morata may not be the answer at the moment, but they looked and felt like a team that need an out-and-out centre-forward. I mean, the one thing Switzerland had, there was always a danger that Seferovic can hold up play and eventually support would come from Mbolo and Shaqiri at times in the rare moments that they did threaten before they went down to 10 men, where after that they didn't do anything. But for Spain, if they had anybody, a proper inside the 18-yard box prowler, they would score 5, 6, 7 in the way that they're playing at the moment. But because they don't have that, so many opportunities get squandered. And when you saw that when they went a man up on the team sheet after Freuler's sending off, they just didn't have anybody that had actual genuine striker's composure in front of goal. And if there's one thing that is going to pull down this Spain side for the great football that they play, it's an iffy defence, and you saw that with the Switzerland goal, that Laporte and Torres get in a whole heap of trouble with each other, and eventually it falls kindly into Shaqiri's path and tucks it away off the inside of the post, did his best to squander the opportunity. But also it's they create all the chances in the world, but they still don't have somebody to stick it away. And at the end of the day, they're going to need that. And I just wonder perhaps if this tournament is just one player too early for them to make a really realistic chance of being a dominant force in European football, and actually perhaps going into the World Cup, if they can find that centre forward in Qatar, they will be incredibly dangerous, but they're not quite there just yet.
Yeah, when I remember back to the Spain sides that were dominant, I think I remember them having Fernando Torres, who at the time was probably the best number nine in the world. He would just absolutely terrify defenders. He had like pace, strength. He was good in the air. And he could finish pretty much any chance that came his way. And so they went from that to Diego Costa, who was pretty much a lot more brute force, but equally just absolutely terrified defenders when he played against them. And they went from that to basically not playing a forward. They had like Fabregas as a false nine. And it was almost like, if we don't have a good forward, then we may as well fully commit to the idea of not having one and just not play one entirely. And just absolutely dominate the midfield and between the lines, and have players running in behind, with the defenders having no one really to mark because no one's playing up against them. And we'll just always have like an extra man or two in midfield. So, and it really worked for them. And I wonder whether, if we could start the tournament again, whether Spain would probably do something similar, knowing what we know now. Would they put Thiago in instead of a forward and just try to absolutely dominate that midfield and have players running on behind the defence from deep positions, which is really hard to defend against? Because Morata and now Moreno, neither of them look confident, neither of them look like they're going to score. And it's kind of hard to dig yourself out of a rut, and you can do it eventually, but the problem in a small tournament is there's only two games left. And so when is eventually going to be? Is it going to be in these two games? Because it has to be.
Yeah. I mean, there's a great story of redemption for Morata if he ends up scoring, you know, five goals in the last two games. And it's like everybody's doubted him throughout this tournament. He has one spark and then doesn't follow it up in the quarterfinals and then dominates the semi-final and final. It's like the Rufus Smalls of Mike Bassett fame, you know, in the post kind of credits, where it's suddenly Smalls, he goes on to dominate that tournament after being so useless earlier. But I just wondered though, with Spain as well, if they did play a false nine. I mean, you can play a false nine, much like Barcelona, much like Barcelona, you know, that kind of generation of players and talent only comes through, you know, once in a blue moon. And Barcelona are still running the coattails off that and trying to hold on to that as much as they can. And I think Spain are in a very similar position because of the quality of those Madrid and Barcelona teams now starting to be faded out of the international team. And while that's a good thing, obviously, to allow players from all over the place to get opportunities in this Spain side, it also means that that golden generation is gone. And so maybe you don't have that ability in the players with enough talent to play that false nine system. It's a really interesting setup, I think, under Luis Enrique for the future of Spanish football at the international level.
I wonder a little bit how much Ansu Fati not being available maybe changed things for Spain, because you look at how he was playing for Barcelona, and I mean, even though he's a kid and you don't want to put that much pressure on someone, it's kind of like the Michael Owen at the 98 World Cup situation, where you think all of his pace and threat in behind, it's exactly what they're missing. And in World Cup 98, eventually Owen started and he tore Argentina to shreds and everyone remembers it. And I just think if Ansu Fati was available for Spain in this tournament, he'd probably start and he'd probably solve a lot of their problems. But I guess that underpins another thing, where your entire hopes as a country are pinned on a very young kid being available and not nervous and performing in a major tournament. So it probably highlights the problem they have, really, in terms of depth in attack. They don't really have anyone that's like pace that can stretch teams vertically, and just basically offer the threats that those guys we said before, Torres, Diego Costa, they just don't have that guy. And it's a big problem.
And even the support finisher like a David Villa as well. I mean, that last missing link is just there to be had for Spain. Can we talk about the Froehlich sending off as well? Because that is a, for me, it's a red card that's ruined what was a tantalising game of football, and it became just a war of attrition for Switzerland. And credit to the Swiss for holding on as long as they did. I mean, I've poo-pooed and panned Rodriguez on numerous occasions in a Milan shirt, and some of his defending today in that back three for Switzerland was quite incredible. That massive block he has towards the end of the second half, just phenomenal. But it all came down to one of the most ludicrous refereeing decisions that I can remember on a massive tournament scale.
Yeah, and it came with English refs as well, which is typical. Playing devil's advocate for a minute, I remember Joe Gomez broke his leg against Burnley, and it wasn't a bad tackle. It was just that it was a very forceful tackle. And I remember Jurgen Klopp making a point, which is very interesting. He basically says, if you go into a tackle with a lot of force, the only place that force can dissipate is into the opposition when you hit them. So if their leg has to absorb the entire force of your body behind it, that's going to do a lot of damage. And it's kind of an interesting thing whereby you want the best players to stay fit and you want them performing, and you don't want someone getting a leg broke with a really aggressive but fair tackle. But can you send someone off for it? It's just like it's a fair tackle. He won the ball. He slid in. When you watch it in real time, I thought it was going to be a red card because he was very quick across the deck and he flew into the tackle. But when you watch it back in slow motion, you don't see that force in the tackle. And I thought it would probably be overturned for that reason, because when you take the actual speed of it out of it, you see that basically he went the ground. He won the ball. He didn't follow through. He didn't have his legs like straight, which is something players do usually when they're trying to hurt someone. It was none of that. It was just like the ball was there to be won. He won it. And it's a shame that it was a red card. I understand why it was given. I don't agree with it. I understand in real time why it was given, but I just expect it to be overturned, and it just wasn't.
Well, that's why I think it's more ludicrous than anything else, because people have had a chance to actually see, and there were so many times that we would slow down challenges that people weren't penalised for in the past, and you'd look at it and it'd be, ooh, studs are coming over the ball, studs are right up, this is a problem. And it wasn't just about the force, it was about the body language and where the feet were and how the player had gone in. And instead now, what we've got is the complete opposite and reverse of that, of a player who's gone in very hard and aggressively, but I don't think it was necessarily uncontrolled by Freuler. And I think you can see it's not uncontrolled because of the way he points his foot. He tries to keep his feet down as much as possible. He's going in with aggression, but I don't know. Again, this is probably sounding like an old man here, but you know, we used to applaud a good, strong, aggressive challenge. We wouldn't get up in arms about it because it might hurt somebody. It was a great challenge. He's taken the ball. It's different, I guess, when you're coming in from the side and you take the ball and the man runs into your leg, as opposed to going in straight on and you are going to go through the opposition player. And that is a worry. But in this situation, after you looked at it time and time again on the replay as they were reviewing it, you just thought, well, no, it's an aggressive challenge that is maybe dangerous, but he's taken the ball, he's kept the studs down as much as he can, as any player can when they're sliding in, and he's tried to point the feet away from the player. He's not trying to go through him, he's just trying to get the ball and ensure he gets there quickly, because it's a desperate moment for his country to try and win the ball back in the middle of the pitch. And that's the other thing, it's in the heart of the pitch as well. It's not like it's Spain cultivating a way through the back line or anything in that moment. So to have the option to review it and not overturn it, I thought was really surprising. And we've made jokes, I think, off the podcast about, you know, the Premier League handling of VAR compared to how it's been handled in this tournament. And then the one time VAR really does get a big balls up, unless you're not a fan of the Di Lorenzo challenge either in today's second game that led to the Lukaku penalty. The one time there's a big balls up, it's the English refs that make the balls up on VAR. And it's like, oh, great, here we go again. I guess things may not change for the English football season after this summer. And as I say, it kills the game as a spectacle as well, because you're suddenly just waiting. You thought it was going to be cat and mouse and Spain were just toying and teasing with Switzerland. And full credit to the Swiss for holding on as long as they did and unfortunately bottling it in the penalty shootout in quite spectacular fashion.
Yeah. I do wonder I remember when Embolo got injured for Switzerland, I kind of thought it, it was game over for Switzerland, or tournament over for Switzerland, because they just lost. He's just such an important player for them the whole tournament. And I thought basically it was a case of whether Spain would score or whether Switzerland could hold on. And I also wonder, is there just like a psychological tiredness where if you've been trying to hang on for like two games in a row, and you get the two penalty shootouts in a row, whether you're just like mentally very, very tired. I remember in other tournaments, it feels like teams who keep getting penalty shootouts eventually just lose one of them. You can't just keep winning penalty shootouts. I kind of thought Switzerland were going to lose as soon as Mbrolo went off, whether even if it got the penalties, I just thought that's the way it would be, even though Spain have a problem scoring penalties, seemingly.
Yeah.
But Switzerland had a bigger problem today. That was the weird thing. It was like all the penalties were awful that were missed. They were just really bad penalties. Akanji's really bothered me because it's like a centre back, and he does that stutter run up thing, and it seemed like he had an idea in his head what was going to happen. Like he had played it through in his mind, and the keeper was going to suggest that he was going to go one way or the other. And then when the keeper didn't do that, he didn't seem to know what to do, and the ball was underneath him, and he sort of just like landed on top of it and scuffed it towards the goal. Absolute mess of a penalty. The penalties were just really bad.
I mean, the best penalty was Moreno's, which, considering he hadn't showed that sort of composure in front of goal in the 90 minutes, I was very surprised about. Moreno's into the top bins in the top right-hand corner was awesome, but I thought all of the Swiss players, when they were walking up, apart from Gavranovic, the first one that obviously was put away, you know, Shah, Akanji, Vargas, they all looked just so nervous compared to the previous night. It was like the France was a free hit, but now they'd set a precedent of being good at penalties, and then there was a fear to live up to that almost. But you have to remember in this game as well, like Spain got a lucky breakthrough through an own goal inside the first 8 minutes, and then couldn't finish. So just looking very briefly ahead to this semi-final that's going to be Spain and Italy, they haven't taken the majority of chances that they've had in this tournament. They have had, of course, we've scored five goals twice in it, which is very impressive, but they haven't played a team perhaps as disciplined as the Italians. I know it sounds punchy to say it, but I do think the Italians have to be kind of odds-on favourites to go through, depending really on what happens with the Spinazzola injury, I guess. That changes it a lot for Italy.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting game just to see. I remember saying about matchup of styles, but I always think in top-level sports, it's about imposing your will. And if Spain can impose their will on the game, control the ball, limit Italy the attacks, and without Spinazzola, they probably just don't have that explosiveness down that flank to really, really worry them. You would say you could see Spain winning. But on the other hand, if Italy are pressing high up the pitch and forcing mistakes out of Spain, and we've seen them already make two really big mistakes in the last two games, giving up goals. So yeah, you could see Italy causing problems for Spain, pressing from the front. In that sense, I would actually like Belotti to play instead of Immobile. I think Belotti scours defenders. He just has that Ian Rush-like ability of just running into defenders from the blind side and appearing when they're not expecting him, and just ambushing them when they have the ball. And I'd like to see Belotti play for that reason. Immobile just really hasn't impressed me the whole tournament. He hasn't really had an impact. I think it's a bit like Harry Kane, where if a player has a lot of the ball and they're confident and they're used to having the ball, so they're not snatching shots and being selfish because they know they're going to get more touches. But when you're only getting a few touches, you end up being really selfish when you do get it, because you're like, well, this might be the only touch of the ball I get for the next 25 minutes, so I may as well have a shot. And I think that's what we're seeing with Immobile, is lots of selfish play, or because he feels like he's sort of on the periphery of the game, and the tournament isn't going the way he thought it would. Maybe
it'll be the Morata hat trick in the semi final, and then he will have to find a way out of Italy as quickly as possible. I'm pretty sure he's going to be on his way out of Juventus anyway this summer, but he's going to be very quick to be departing Turin as soon as possible and not heading back at all.
Yeah. The other thing I noticed at the end of the Spain versus Switzerland game, there's only seven, I think it was seven outfield players that started the match. They were still on the pitch because there's so many substitutions now, and the red card. And it made me think that one of the things I was thinking was Spain obviously going into extra time, two games in a row might have a fitness issue for them coming into the match. It'd be like heavy legs, but with so many substitutes now, the team that starts the match pretty much doesn't end the match. So I'm not sure it actually matters. It's a bit like basketball. We'll have our own subs team.
Why Football Happens reaction podcast will be back tomorrow when we break down the other quarterfinals that includes, obviously, England against the Ukraine. In the meantime, while you're waiting for that, get on to Twitter at @podcast_WFH. That's @podcast_WFH to stay abreast of when all of our podcasts are dropping. And of course, get on to anchor.fm, our host, and all good podcasting outlets to rate, review, and subscribe so you never miss an episode of Why Football Happens. Until then, take care.